and welcome to another live edition of the Face of Pro-Life. Today I'm very pleased to be speaking with Dr. Lorraine Hartnett, and she's going to be talking a little bit about caring for the most vulnerable in society. Thank you for joining us today, Lorraine.
Thank you.
We are going to talk for a little bit, maybe like a half hour, and then we really would like you to call in with your questions or comments, and the phone number is 546-3000, so write that down and call us in about a half an hour. As a society, you know, we're always concerned in the pro-life movement on whether or not people, our most vulnerable, are being taken care of. How are we doing as a society in taking care of our most vulnerable at this point?
Well, I think that depends where you are. If you're in my house, then you're doing very well. And my 83-year-old father, who was thrown out in a nursing home where they stopped giving all care to him.
Really?
Is now at home, walking, going to church, and reading his newspaper, and haranguing me as often as he can. So the pro-life movement is very active on an individual basis in homes, taking care of the vulnerable. Once you enter an institution, I think you're in trouble.
So just go back a little bit. How did your father get thrown out of the private institution? I mean, what did you mean he stopped getting care?
He was in a nursing home that shall remain nameless. Mm-hmm. And because he was 80 years old, had a hip fracture and had dementia and a delirium, which is kind of a super dementia state that's temporary after surgery or mm-hmm. some medications, they decided, the doctors and the nurses there and the other professionals, that the physical therapists and occupational therapists, that, you know, he wasn't going to get better, so they weren't going to waste their resources on helping him. So he was basically locked up in a dementia unit, placed in a diaper, in a wheelchair, with a seatbelt, and that was it.
Wow.
And that was it. And I would go visit him, and I would lie on the floor next to his bed on a pad that they put there so that if he fell out,
right,
he wouldn't hurt himself. And that was the way it was.
So if you weren't a physician, and like an average person, do you think most people would just let their loved one?
Well, I think most people don't know. They listen to the healthcare professionals. So, and this is indeed what happened. The person who was responsible for my father at the time, his wife, my mother had died, he got remarried, a wonderful woman, was actually told that he wasn't going to get better and that they weren't going to do physical therapy because he was at the top of his, you know, progression. So that was it. So she was told to sign off on the Medicare so that now he wouldn't be on Medicare anymore. And that was that. So people believe what they're told.
Right.
We as healthcare professionals have a tremendous responsibility in transmitting the truth to our patients and their families. But if we are not in a state of grace, mm-hmm. sitting next to Jesus spiritually, constantly, then how can we tell
the truth?
How can we know the truth? If we don't know the truth, how can we present the truth? So that's what happens. And people don't know. They trust people in power.
I mean, I think that's the scariest part, is that, you know, the average person, like I said, like you say your stepmother, she didn't know any different.
No.
And so this is, I'm sure, played out daily.
Absolutely.
Throughout the world.
Absolutely.
So what was different, you know, besides you being a physician? How did you get him out of there?
Well, actually, what happened was I am a physician, but I was in the midst of the throes of the whole situation too. Mm-hmm. I had taken time off from work. This is my father who
right.
I saw like that.
Right.
So I was caught off guard.
Well, because you now become a doctor. I mean,
yes,
a daughter, not a doctor.
Right. And I didn't even know if this was true, what they were telling
right.
me.
Right.
I didn't know. Was this the way my father was going to be for the rest of his life?
Wow.
I didn't know.
Right.
But you know what? I had to take a chance
mm-hmm.
because I knew in my heart that my father was in there. And thanks be to God for my husband, my lovely husband, who said one night as we were leaving, "We got to get your father out of here."
Oh, how sweet.
So he consented It was actually his idea to bring him home. And it's hard to do that. But I think the moment of decision was that glimpse of grace when I saw that maybe the truth was something else. Maybe this wasn't the whole truth. And it had been a short time since his injury. So, wait, we have to give him a chance. Mm-hmm. And then I went and I investigated and I found out that there was this delirium which happens postoperatively, especially in
elderly people. Yeah.
Yes. And that might last even a year. So this was not the time to give up. This was the time to hunker down and do our best. And I think that has to be the attitude when you take care of patients. That's how I was taught. Okay? I was taught that you, as long as there's a glimmer of life, you take care of that person. Mm-hmm. Now, do you have to make decisions? Sure. Is it obvious when some people are at death's door that they don't they shouldn't get a resuscitation and the CPR? Of course. That's human dignity is involved there. But if there's a spark of life, you go for it until you know that the Lord's calling them home. Mm. And it is fairly obvious when that's happening.
I was going to ask you that because, you know, I mean, there's so many times, I mean, even you hear young people get in maybe closed head trauma or, you know, and they're on a ventilator or, you know, and their parents are told, you know, there's no hope. How do you know there's no hope?
Well,
when do you know?
You know, you don't know there's no hope until, you know, the body's in the ground. Really, there's hope. As long as there's life, there's hope. And I think that has to be our attitude. Mm-hmm. As long as there's life, let's err on the side of life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Today, I was even reading an article a speech that Ronald Reagan had given in 1983 about this, because he was so incensed about abortion being codified in this country. And he talked about the value of life. And he said, let's err on the side of life. I mean, this was our politician.
I think what really woke him up was the fact that they were starving babies to death, you know, ones that either had been born alive from abortion or like babies that were born with birth defects.
Right.
And he was just totally incensed. It's like, because they were just, this was institutional. It was, that's what they were doing.
And that was in 1983.
Yeah.
Okay. And now we have a president who actually was a proponent of killing babies who were born alive.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's frightening.
Mm-hmm.
That's frightening. And his advisors are now developing a healthcare system that certainly will not err on the side of life, but will err on the side of money.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of people, you know, were demonizing opponents of the president's health care bill, you know, saying, oh, you know, you don't want people to get health care. And that is so false. I mean, because as a physician, what is our biggest fear with this health care?
I think what people want is to have a physician who takes care of them, to be able to get the care they need when they need it. That's what people want.
Mm-hmm.
A physician is not a replacement for the family.
Right.
A physician, an institution, is not a substitution for the family or for other people around who love you. Okay? That's not it. We are simply people who have been put there by God in a vocation to speak for God, I believe, about health care and what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And people want to be taken care of when they need it. They want what they need. They want to be able to trust someone who can make those decisions. And they want to have accessibility to the latest advances. I mean, that's what America was founded on. People
ingenuity,
who wanted, who wanted better things. They didn't want someone telling them what to do, be it their religion or anything else. So we're a country of people like that. So to think that we've been lulled into this sleep-like state where we just allow the government to take more and more away from us is really frightening. But there's always hope. You said, when is hope over? You know, there's always hope. Look at in that same speech by Ronald Reagan. I don't know how I was led to it today, but he spoke about the civil rights movement. And people thought, you know, that was a dead issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this is the way people were treated. But, and even the Supreme Court, okay, had codified certain discrimination, you know, codified in law. But the Supreme Court was overturned.
Right.
The Dred Scott decision was overturned.
Sure.
And then when Martin Luther King came on the scene, what he did was he inflamed that desire in everyone's heart for what our Constitution
yeah.
states,
right.
which is that everyone has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit. Everyone
One.
Who lives and breathes is endowed by his creator, right? This is what it says.
Right.
So I think that has to give the pro-life movement hope too,
mm-hmm.
because we can go forward and we can overturn.
Well,
even
this whole country shouldn't
impossible.
Be here. I mean, there's no way that anyone would have predicted that the rebels would have beat the British army.
Of course not.
So there's hope.
But, you know, it was God's will.
Yeah.
Most likely. Where else is
right.
there a country that's like this? So I think in terms of what people want to get care. They want to trust, and they want to get care.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know that someone's taking care of them. They do not expect to go into a nursing home and be told prematurely that they shouldn't get any care.
Right, right.
No, they don't want that. I don't think
they want that.
I don't think I think they want to be cared for. But unfortunately, so many things are happening in medicine now.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about the universal health care. Sure, it's great. Everybody needs health care. But if you look in the state of Connecticut, there were only 330,000 people who didn't have health care. And how many of them don't want health care? And
mm-hmm.
how many of them could get health care with existing things? There's really no need to reinvent the wheel
everything.
Unless you have an agenda.
Yeah. So let's say, you know, we wiped the slate clean and you were writing a health care bill. What
yes.
were the things you would attack?
Well, I would make sure that everyone has the ability to purchase health care.
And how would you do that?
Well, I'm certainly not an economist, but I think we have existing institutions and in our society which deal in healthcare. We
mm-hmm.
have hospitals, we have insurance companies, and I think the problem is that people don't have access to buying because it's too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there has to be an option where people who aren't insured by their business, the place of business, can actually buy a reasonable insurance. That's what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
I would keep a free market economy and have the market determine how
the
much
price,
we would pay.
Right.
The problem, I think, is that there's too many people involved with too many agendas.
Right.
And this whole idea of we already have Medicare, which is a government option. Okay,
mm-hmm.
We already have Medicaid. We already have a lot of government insurance.
Let me ask you, as a physician, what do physicians think of Medicare and Medicaid?
Well, I think, you know, as a person, we have to take care of people. And Medicare was started a long time ago, and people depend on it. So it would take a whole change in culture to get a generation or
off
several
of
generations of people used to the idea that they were going to buy their own health care in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly how socialism works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you get people lulled into
right.
having Big Brother give you something.
Right.
So why
These
bother
entitlements.
Having to think
right.
for yourself?
Right.
Right. Why
right.
bother? Why bother? Someone's going to give it to me. So I think we need to have a way that people get this care, but we have to train doctors in a way that they are informed by pro-life principles
yeah.
so that they make the right decisions.
Now,
that's not happening.
Do you believe there are enough physicians and nurses currently to...
No, of course not.
Yeah, I don't think...
Of course not.
And I don't see anything in the bill that's going to encourage doctors or
no.
people to become doctors.
All it will do is cause more people to be imported from other countries to become... To
yeah.
be doctors here. That's what will happen.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, I mean, I'm a doctor because that's my vocation.
Right.
I wouldn't have done anything else. But I can tell you right now that when I go to see patients, certain patients who are on Medicare or Medicaid, I receive $12 or $16.
Right.
That's what I'm just telling you that because people have to know. You know, doctors are not rich people. That you know, there might have been a time in this country when the doctor in the community was a well respected
right.
member of the community. But you know that guy, and most of them were guys, would stay up all night a lot of times, would be at your house whenever you were
yeah.
sick, would make house calls. He gave his whole life to the community.
Yeah.
So and he had pro-life principles.
Yeah.
So of course he would be, you know, a respected part of society.
Right.
But once doctors stop doing that, hey, once you got more interested in your Jaguar than in your patients, once, how did abortion ever come to be? I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know where I was. I guess I was in high school. I was in college. I certainly wasn't like I am now. But how did physicians ever let that come to be? This is a mystery to me still.
Well, it's very lucrative.
Well, it is very lucrative. And I think there probably was a group that was pushing that, because there's a whole industry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But once we did that, the point of this, my whole line of thought here was, if doctors let that happen without getting out in the streets and demonstrating against it, or
right. You know,
without stopping medical care and saying, we are not going to put up with this. We are not trained to kill. We're trained to help people live. If doctors and nurses didn't stand up for it, and I speak for the doctors now, because I think the doctors were the keepers, just as God always put people in charge of certain areas, the doctors were the keepers of medicine. This is the way it was.
Right.
Just like the judges were the keepers. That's
the
way.
Justice, right.
It's too much work for everybody, so you got to get... Exactly.
You dole it out.
But what we did was we let it happen. So once we let it happen and forgot about that, and let, you know, what we were supposed to do be taken over by others.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to look at the scripture to see what God does in that circumstance when we don't obey his law. What does he do? He lets you be taken over by your enemies so that you get taught a lesson.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Our enemies are now in charge, and we're going to get taught a lesson. And I just hope that we do get taught a lesson, because hope is always active, okay? We can still stand up for what's right. We can still reverse what's going on. We can take off those blinders as I say, hey, wait a second. There's an abortion being done 3 operating rooms down. What the heck am I doing here as a Catholic doctor?
Right.
Hold on. You know, that's what needs to happen.
People, but it sounds like it's going to get worse, because, one, a lot of the schools are forcing the students to, you know, do rotations through abortion clinics and stuff like that. And these new healthcare laws, you know, are not giving provisions to people who have conscientious objections
of
to
course.
Certain things. And, you know, they're basically pushing, like you said, the enemy is basically pushing on the doctors from all sides. You know, I mean, the doctors are being overregulated by the government and by the insurance companies. And going back to what you said before, is everybody wants to have the relationship with their doctor. But it seems like there's so many different levels of bureaucracy and crap
and
being put between you and your doctor.
Right, and it will get worse. You're right. The new healthcare proposals, be they the national or the Connecticut Sustinet, put a lot more levels between you and your doctor.
I don't understand how that's going to lower healthcare. We've got more layers of people getting paid.
It's not
professionals getting paid to do a job.
It's double talk. It's called lies. It's the same reason why pro-choice means you can kill your baby in your womb. Okay? It's pro-choice. You know, it's the same thing. It's that language thing. Okay? We have to speak up about this. We have to... there's a whole sea change that has to happen. But we're living in a society which no longer has a Christian ethics operative.
Right.
There's secular ethics.
Mm-hmm.
So you have secular ethicists whose code of behavior is one of not the dignity of life, okay, but the quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And who decides on the quality of life? Who decides on that? Well, to me, God does. If he created you, you're special. You're holy. You have the potential for sanctity, and he wants you back. So when we are no longer a Christian in our ethics, but we are secular in our ethics, we lose that moral ground, and people are telling us what to do.
Yeah.
So we have hospice coming into nursing homes and putting people on Q2-hour morphine, and there you go. There's your family member dead in a couple of days. Compassionate care. Because they need to die.
Yeah. Yeah, because who would want to live like that?
It's their time.
Yeah.
Who would want to live like that? Not, oh, If someone's living and is needing help, perhaps the person who's taking care of them needs to perform those acts of charity.
Right.
Okay? And those works of mercy, right, that our church talks about and says that we're obligated to do and that will get us to heaven.
Right.
Okay?
And it's the individuals, not the state, that
of
should
course,
be doing all
of
this.
Of course.
This acts of That's charity.
That principle of subsidiarity, everybody has to look it up and read about it because it's very simple. But it's one of those Catholic social principles that says that whatever can be done by a smaller unit should not be done by a big unit.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense. But when you talk about the implications of that are very, very wide. As I was thinking about that today, does that mean that a mother should stay home and take care of her children and educate them? Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah, it does. This is something that's been bugaboo with me for a long time. I mean, I think people get confused. You know, Catholic charity, meaning in social justice, you know, when they say social justice, you know, that means that you as an individual, you as a Catholic community, need to reach out to the poor. You need to reach out to the sick. You need to reach out to children to educate them. Don't push your responsibilities off on the state.
Right.
The more money that we have to give to the state in taxes for them to educate our children, to pay for Medicare, to pay for welfare, the less money the church has to do all of those same things that they invented. The church founded schools, the church founded hospitals.
That's right.
These are the things that the church has the purview to do. And not only did they lose money and the opportunity to, you know, do these acts of charity, but they lose the opportunity to evangelize at the same time.
No, of course. And isn't that a great plan if you're against the church
exactly.
and against the people of God? I mean, see, to me, it doesn't really surprise me because I look at things like that and with the big picture, you know. Remember?
I know.
The woman with the foot on the head of the snake. Hold on, yeah.
So anything that the church can do, we should not be encouraging the government to do. Because
that's
it takes
right.
away everything.
That's a person can do. And the reasons for that are many. But besides the fact that you'd cut socialism right at the knees,
right.
you know, there'd be no totalitarianism,
Absolutely.
Okay, with everything that it brings. Okay, so we're talking about these death panels
right.
or these medical homes that are part of the Connecticut Sustinet program.
Yeah, what is that all about?
Well, that's everyone who belongs to this program, which you'll pretty much have to unless you have private insurance. And I'm not into all the details yet, but what everybody who belongs to it will have a medical home, and this is a concept that's been bandied around in these universal healthcare circles. And basically what it means in a nutshell is every decision about your healthcare is going to have to go through a committee. Okay? And the committee is going to say whether you can have it or not. Okay? So guess what?
Oh, to pay for the
okay.
committee.
Guess what? 15 years when I'm a 74-year-old overweight woman, you think I'm going to get the best medical care?
Oh, yeah, don't they have an obesity panel?
Oh, yeah, they have an
obesity
panel. How much am I going to have to pay? I don't know. I did get my Nordic track this week, so I'm going to cut down on what I give that government. But there is humor in all of this, but the humor has to bring us to the point where we say, hey, wait a second,
let's wake up.
We can't... I recently talked to a guy who is from Miami. He's part of my company, and his family's from Cuba. Mm-hmm. And he said that and we started talking about all these issues. And he said, my grandmother took me aside, and she said, Miguel, don't let what happened in Cuba happen here. Because what happened was this revolution, this change.
Mm.
Nobody sold it as what they got.
Oh,
okay.
I know.
So what they got was what they got, which was people starving, no health care, no nothing, no freedom.
No religion.
No freedom, okay? So we have to have the freedom to perform charity.
Right. Absolutely.
This subsidiarity, of course, also means this. When it's all about charity so that we can perform charitable works. Not only that, but we can perform charitable works for somebody who may be disabled, okay, the marginalized, the disabled, the elderly. We can do charitable works for them so that
they can rise to their own level of being, and that their being is dignified, and that they can be a source of charity for others, or they can perform charitable work. Yeah. So we were just talking about this on the way up here.
And I always come back to you mentioned the fact that, you know, call it sexist, but, you know, should women stay home and raise their children? And my answer is, of course they should. They can do all they should be to do that. But not only that, but if women are in the home, they have more opportunity to volunteer. And all of those things that used to be done by the volunteers, you know, would lower the cost of healthcare, that, you know, would lower the cost of education, would lower the cost of all
these things. You wouldn't have to have people in nursing homes. No. What used to happen is that mothers stayed home to take care of their children. And so the elderly grandma would be there in the house, too.
Right.
And when they got sick, well, you're not going to throw grandma into a nursing home. I mean, there were plenty of countries where they don't exist. Nursing homes don't exist in Poland. You know.
Who and could afford it?
They don't exist. People take care of their elderly at home. And that's what has to happen. And it is not sexist. Okay. Sexist is a term from the feminazi movement, of which I was a very proud card-carrying member. But I never believed that abortion was right. So that was the chink in the armor. Even when I was on those demonstrations, I said, no. Wait a second. This doesn't make any sense. Half the babies being aborted are women.
Right.
And the people going through this procedure are women.
Right.
This doesn't make any sense.
And there's really nothing more feminine than having a baby.
Well, there's the highest form of existence of a woman is to give birth, right? Mm-hmm. Like our Blessed Mother gave birth to Jesus. This is our model. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is undercut here. Yeah. So what happens? You think of something so basic as that. That really strikes me. That's undercut. So then what happens? Kids go to school. They get taught what the schools want to teach them because they're being taught by teachers who belong to the teachers' union. The most liberal organization.
Which we know their agenda
is. Or the backers of all these universal health care plans, by the way.
And the homosexual agenda.
Yeah, so it's very complex. And to anybody who's listening, it can seem overwhelming. It seems overwhelming to us, okay? But I just encourage people to just, do that act of charity that you can do. At the moment that you can do it.
Right.
And that counteracts all of this.
Right.
Okay. So it seems big. It seems big to me as a physician. I mean, I have a group, you know, the Eucharistic Helpers of the Sick. Well, we don't have many doctors coming, I can tell you that. Because they don't have time or whatever. The blinders are over their face. It seems too much.
Right.
It seems almost too
overwhelming.
Big. And the ones that are very pro-life can be very angry because they've lived for so long trying to fight. So you get kind of hard. But I think the answer is in our own, you know, personal holiness to embrace that contemplative, you know, state that we're all called to be one with Jesus, to have our, you know, our heads on his chest, and from there to go out and work.
I think one of the words that you mentioned before that is very important is vocation. And that, you know, when you are a physician, when you're a mother, when you're, you know, anything that you do, it should be a vocation, a calling. And so you think of it as you're doing God's work. And so you don't feel like, you know, oh, I have to, you know, drive a Jaguar, you know, I have to, you know, make millions of dollars. And I mean, it's something that, you know, you take each person and treat them with individual dignity and like it's like a vocation.
Of course. And of course, this is what's happened in medicine is that we've gotten away from that vocational aspect. So there's no longer the Hippocratic Oath as it used to be. We no longer have the Christian principles guiding and the Judeo-Christian principles guiding our health care, but now we have the secular ethics, so we get separated from the joy that comes in caring for people.
Right.
You know, that's what keeps me going. That joy. You know, I don't think I'm going to visit a bunch of old ladies in a nursing home. I mean, these are my friends, and these are people who need help, and it is a gift that I am there to be with them.
Yeah.
And they're all praying for me.
Yeah.
You know, that's it's that human interaction and the dignity
with which we interact that makes life bearable, isn't it?
I think you, again, hit it right on the nail. Is, you know, is as far as our country gets farther and farther away from this Judeo-Christian values, you can see it everywhere. I mean, look at Wall Street right now. We've got all of this stuff going on in Wall Street. Well, you can't expect to take God out of the schools and take God out of society and then expect people to act ethically.
Of course not.
So it's a different
ethic. It's a different ethic. So you even have people say, well, it's okay what they did on Wall Street. That's what they do on Wall Street. I'm like, wait a second. When I was growing up, you used to call a guy like that a thief or a Shylock. Hold on, you know? And you know, but human, you're right. The ethics have gone so that we no longer are happy with having a beautiful family.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one of the best things that has ever happened to me is that my father came to live with me because it gave me joy in having that home. I could never have children, so I have a home. You know, my husband and I always joke like this. Sometimes he's like 42-year-olds, but it's not easy. But we have a lot of fun, and we have a family again.
Yeah.
We have a family, you know, and we all care about each other. And yeah, some of us are not perfect. I'm not perfect, and he's not perfect in other ways. My husband isn't perfect in other ways. It works because that's what God wants, and we all have to have that, you know, that interaction that. Very dignified interaction of
the
one human
touch,
being to another. And that's what's missing. That's what's been beaten out of medicine. So now, I mean, I left the ER because of my father, and now I do wound care, so I go at my own pace.
Right.
So I spend much more time than I need to because I love the people, you know? I mean, I don't really, no one's telling me. So, but you do feel that external pressure from sources that aren't always obvious. Like you get the report of how, and now you get reports when you're a doctor about, you know, how much money you make per person and how
right.
I mean, it's so minuscule, it's ridiculous. Like how much you make in a minute. You know, that's what they tell you when you work for an institution. So subtly, that does affect the human being because you want to perform too. So it's without God, there'd be nothing. Somebody else said that. Without God, there's nothing. It's God alone. That's it. We need to be right face to face with God every day and realize that we're here for a reason. That's our vocation. Discover it and stick with it.
Mm-hmm.
And some have been lost, and it's very sad.
A lot have been lost.
All right, I'm an optimist, okay?
We got
a lot, okay?
I mean, one of the things you were saying was, as far as my big bugaboo is general practitioners. I mean, there are so few general practitioners anymore, and you need to have a general practitioner in order to go to a specialist. Now, there's lots of specialists. Because there's a lot of Americans who want, you know, go into medicine and they want to be specialists because that's where they're going to get the bucks. But if you, the book that I got in Massachusetts of the general care, internal medicine, or
family
practitioners, not one of them was either trained at an American university or was born in the United States. And I'm not saying that that's bad, but it's like, where are our American physicians? Where are our American?
Well, I think the more the lower you get on the food chain, so to speak. Okay, the general practitioners are out there seeing everybody. Okay, so the more you get to that level, the more patients you have to see per day, the more it's exhausting. I mean, a general practitioner is expected to see like between 30 and 40 patients a day.
Wow.
Or even more sometimes. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Plus doing their hospital rounds and
And then doing the paperwork.
Yeah.
And then being on the phones with the insurance companies. It's daunting. Nobody wants to do
that.
It's not that everybody who goes into specialties wants to be rich. It's just that I think you have less of that kind of stuff. There's the multitudes coming into you.
Too overwhelming.
And it's over. You can't do the job. You can't spend time with people.
Yeah.
I mean, there are literally doctors who have like timers in their office.
Yeah.
You know, 5 minutes is up.
Well,
that's
not only
out.
That, but you can't get an appointment with them
at all. There are none that that take many insurances. I know. It's a terrible thing.
So,
it is.
So we just added on you know, supposedly all these people who weren't insured, and we expected just everybody to be able to go to the doctor tomorrow.
It's not gonna
happen. Such a joke.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You know, in any country that has socialized medicine or universal health care or whatever euphemism you want to call it, okay, managed care, right. Managed carelessness is what I used to call it. It's, then you're going to get a system where there aren't enough doctors. You're waiting a long time to see a doctor.
Yeah.
If you need a procedure that is not, life or limb saving, then you're going to wait a heck of a long time for it.
And so we've done nothing to alleviate that bottleneck. We've done nothing to encourage, you know, general practitioners. We've not done nothing to encourage young people from going into medicine. So it doesn't make any sense.
Well, no one's going to want to go in if you lose the
your
basic vocational aspect of medicine. You are not going to get people to go into it because you'd have to be insane.
Mm-hmm.
There's no
mm-hmm.
one. The stuff that we do, you know, you get the grace of state. Okay, there's grace that comes down on every physician who works, whether they know whether they're Catholic or Christian or something else, or God, of course, dispenses grace so you can take care of his children. So you get that grace of state to do what you're doing. It doesn't come from you at all.
Right.
But when you get away from that idea that that there's a God-given grace
mm-hmm.
and that you can be joyful in doing what you're supposed to be doing for God. You know,
you don't run into too many of those doctors.
I think there are more than we know.
Yeah.
Most of them are very depressed or have given up. Seriously. They, you know, it's like, hey, this is the way we live right now. And it's very hard. But we must get that joy in seeing the patients. And, you know, this is what we try to do in our group is to, like, you know, encourage a prayer life. So you're going to Mass every day or as much as you can. You're spending time in adoration. You're you know, we need that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get back.
The vitamins.
We need to get back to those old
basics,
things,
yeah.
Those basics of our faith. So we are awake, you know, we're awake to what's going on. Because without that clarity of thought that comes from being very close to Jesus, we're lost.
Right. And it's not just physicians. It's the you know, the parents and the you know, children of elderly parents.
Right.
And
so it's not just the physicians. It's everyone.
Everybody.
It's everyone. How can we have that clarity of thought to say, oh, what that doctor is telling me is wrong? You know,
right.
you have to be, you know, you have to be in a
centered
state of grace. And you have to, this comes to me, you have to be right next to Jesus and Mary. Like, that at the foot of the cross is where you have clarity. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And once you move out of there and you think you lose the redemptive nature of suffering, okay, you don't understand
right.
that anymore, then you know what? The fact that Mrs. Jones, who's 100, is suffering with cancer, maybe she does deserve to go to her maker
mm-hmm.
quicker than, you know, it seems is happening. Once you lose that perspective of, you know, the value of human suffering, then you get to that secular notion of the quality
of life,
not the sanctity of life.
I want to talk a little bit more on that, but I just wanted to remind the viewers that they can call in and ask Dr. Hartnett any question or if they have a comment. And our phone number is 456-3000, I think.
Everybody's sleeping. It's a bad day. It's raining. Raining out there.
The question, or one of the things I wanted to touch back on, and we talk about this a lot, and I don't understand, people just don't get it, like you said, is that there is value in suffering. And not only is there value in suffering, there's value in taking care of the person who's suffering.
Yeah.
You know, so it's easy for someone to say, oh, I can't stand to see them suffer. You know, it'd be easier on me if, you know, we just gave them the morphine and let them go. It'd be easier on them if we just gave them the morphine and let them go. That isn't God's will. You know,
no.
God's will is
definitely
for,
not.
You know, is for you to gain the graces from taking care of that person
yes.
and for them to gain the graces from suffering and dignity. Not dying in dignity, suffering and dignity.
Suffering and dignity so that they...
And nobody wants to hear that.
Chop a little time off that purgatory sentence. Hey, you know, I think Sister Mary Claudine or something taught me that in first grade. You
know, I was better here than there.
Right. Suffering is valuable. This is what I tell my patients. Now, I never go in and say, oh, it's great you're suffering.
Right.
But I do talk to them about suffering. And I usually talk to them about Jesus on the cross. You know, and say, I'm a Christian. And, you know, my God was crucified.
Right.
Now, that was my king and my God. So if that happened, then that must mean that suffering is valuable. Because through that, we were saved.
Right.
So your suffering is valuable. You might not understand it now, but for you or for somebody else, your suffering is very valuable. And we have to know that.
We do have a phone call from Eileen in Windham. Hello, Eileen. Eileen, are you there?
Hello, Lorraine. This is Eileen. I'm in Windham.
Hi, Eileen.
And I'm calling to ask you about the assisted suicide suit that has been presented to the Connecticut Supreme Court. At this point, it's sitting in the Supreme Court, and it looks like they're going to throw it out, saying that it's not really a matter for the Supreme Court to decide whether or not to legalize assisted suicide, and it is a legislative issue. If that happens, what can we do to quickly educate people and rally them around to fight against this, to contact their lobbyists, etc.?
Well, I think that the truth is the truth, and the truth will set you free. And what we have to do is stop calling things by terms that kind of couch this in some kind of gentle kind of terminology. Physician-assisted suicide. No, it's your doctor's killing you is what would be happening. That's what would be happening. And if you said that to someone, would you ask your doctor to kill you? You know, there would be people who would want that because they lose hope. But yeah. Most of those people have some kind of a psychiatric or psychological problem. So I think what we need to do as a Catholic community and a Christian community is get out there and talk about the truth to everyone you see, okay?
Get the truth out, right.
Get the truth out is the only way, okay? Now, certainly we can contact our legislators, no problem. You know, I think a time is coming, and I'm certainly not the one to arrange this, but I just feel like, you know, civil disobedience is like gonna break out because we are coming to the point where these issues are being shoved down our throats, and we are being forced to pay taxes in a state that condones these things. I'm very uncomfortable with that myself. So I think we have to get out and talk the truth to people.
Right.
And remember that that Americans are part of a long line of people who wanted truth and freedom and go back to our roots and what our Constitution says, what our catechism says, and rally the masses. I mean, what else can we do, Eileen? Do you have a suggestion?
No, absolutely. Get the truth out is what I'm thinking. What we're looking for are methodologies and techniques. We're doing it quickly and effectively.
Well,
the truth being that most people who opt for or are interested in assisted suicide have already been brainwashed. They're depressed or they're afraid of pain. They're not properly educated on pain and their depression is not being treated.
That's correct.
We need to get this out. What we need to do with these patients is not kill them, but treat them and love them.
Absolutely. And isn't that the case with all of these anti-life maneuvers which come in, be it the hospice movement or be it physician-assisted suicide?
Or abortion.
You know, the truth needs to come out, and people have to be given hope, and we have to give them a way to express themselves. But they have to kind of be awakened, you know. Mm-hmm. If I had an antidote to this sleep.
Yeah.
You know, is the truth.
People need to be awakened and to care. Oftentimes, the attitude is, well, it's not going to affect me. But with the baby boomers, it is going to affect them and their parents.
Especially when we're starting to ration health care and people, you know, as people get older and older you know, the resources are, you know, limited, you know, people are going to think, oh, well, it's better for me to just allow my physician to kill me so that I don't become a burden to my family.
They already say that.
Yeah.
They already say that. I hear the elderly saying that all the time, and then I don't want to be a burden. I'd rather just die. I don't. Because why is that? Why is that?
Because we don't
because
value them.
Because they're lonely in these places. No one's going to visit them.
Right.
I'm sorry. Their families are not coming to visit them. And anyone, probably people listening to this, would visit their families. But most of these people in nursing homes are basically abandoned there. And
Absolutely.
Very, very rarely does anybody come to visit or show any love. And hey, let's face it. Let's face it. Would you want to live like that?
Yeah. No.
All of these people need love. I feel that that's part of my mission now is to just bring that love. You know,
well, that's what the volunteers used to do.
Exactly.
We used to have women that volunteered.
And
that's
do
what
have,
they did.
They still have volunteers, but they have hospice volunteers too.
Yeah.
So they'll come in and help you while you're dying with dignity. It's
I think part of the treatment, if you're treating a patient in a hospital for depression, part of the treatment should be working with the family, too, and helping them to realize and get them to behave properly to come back to that person and bring that person love and visit and spend time with that person.
Absolutely.
Something really worth living for.
You know, and Eileen, are you a nurse?
No.
But you've seen enough.
Yes. I have.
And people...
I've had this in my own family, a number of incidences.
Mm-hmm. And I think I've been very fortunate because in my own family, I have also had that. So I've learned very well that you got to keep on pushing, you know, keep on pushing. Someone may be suicidal. Someone may want to die with an illness, but there's always some joy that can be found and you can bring joy.
Actually, I'm dealing right now with a 93-year-old mother who, if she doesn't get the right amount of attention, will become depressed. She has some dementia.
Yes.
But the minute you give her the attention, boy, she's chipper again.
Yes, and what I love is these people who everybody says don't talk and they don't, you know, they're not responding. All you have to do is put on a nice song and start singing one of those old songs from the 40s, and their foot starts tapping. And they start
human touch, you know, like even just giving them some lotion on their hands and rubbing them, you know, their arms.
Simple things. Another part of it, though, that I think is not simple and is something for the clergy to figure out is that the pastoral care of these people is seriously lacking.
Yeah.
I know because I look for masses in every place that I go because I want to go to daily mass. So when I go to nursing, I look at the schedule every month, see when they're, well, let's face it, there aren't many masses. And not many people are going in there. Not many people who could administer the sacraments.
Right.
Confession. Sure, you have the extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion who come in. But that's sometimes almost just a formality kind of thing. I don't want to discourage anybody from doing that. But it's not the sacrament given by a priest. People need that. And I think that's where we need vocations to the priesthood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's sorely lacking. And we have, I liken it to people being in Siberia. We have these elderly Catholic people who have lived their whole life and given their whole life sometimes to the church, who, you know, made the first Saturdays a million times. You know, we know they're going to be okay. But they're sitting there with no one visiting them. They get no pastoral care. They're not getting the sacraments. And they're just like forgotten in Siberia these nursing homes and these wards. Thank God for the people who work in nursing homes. I'm not saying everyone, but the CNAs, anybody out there who's a CNA, the CNAs who work in the nursing homes oftentimes love these patients like they're their own family. And it's so uplifting to me when I see that. You know, the nurses and the CNAs oftentimes really love people like they're their own family. So
like
there
is
love.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like it is. Of course, these are the people making $12 an hour.
Yeah.
But we won't go there. But they're doing God's work, and that's all that matters.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Oh, thank you, Eileen.
It was so nice talking to you. You're right on.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Eileen. God bless you. Thank you.
Please
pray for me.
We have another call from Mike from Lebanon. Hi, Mike.
Yes.
Did you have a question or comment?
It's a comment. Actually, kind of strange. About an hour and a half ago, I saw in a on a TV program, which I won't mention, that when they're in the process of going through this health care, forming it up and writing it out and all that stuff, the guy that was on there was one of the, I guess he was one of the writers of it, or at least one of the admin for it, was saying that in order to keep costs down, what they would have to do would be to emphasize quality in disregard quantity, which kind of means to me that you're forced to pay for health insurance just to say that you have health insurance, but when the time comes, there's no guarantee you're going to get the service.
Absolutely.
I think you're absolutely correct in being concerned about that, Mike. And I would suggest that you talk to everyone you know about that, because what will happen with any kind of universal health care will be rationed, okay? You will get less care for people who need it at the end of life, who are not perfect. They'll decide when your end of life is, and if you're worthy of treatment. These medical homes that we talked about with Sustinet will have a committee that decides if you get care. And the care will be determined by people who do not have the same values that you have.
Right.
One of the people who had a lot to do with many of the ideas in Obamacare is the brother of Rahm Emanuel, is Ezekiel Emanuel. He's a physician. And basically, he expounds on these ideas and talks about rationing care at the end of life to those who do not meet up with the standards.
And his rationing of care means between age 16 and 40.
Oh, yeah.
We're not talking 80 or 90.
That's
16
right.
and 40.
If you look at his
it's
graph.
It's not like a communist, like we need the workers.
Yeah, I had a graph with me, and it's called the Reaper graph. It shows, like, when you get to 70, the care just drops off. And, Mike, I'm 59, so I got 11 good years yet. I'm going to go out fighting, I can tell you that. I just pray to God he keeps me going so I don't need to get that care. But, you know, you're right, Mike, and it's scary to all of us. I mean, I'm in healthcare, and it's hard. It's hard to get a regular doctor to take care of you. And we need to speak out against this. Of course, the trap that we're in is that no one really knows what's in the health care bill. So they'll say, why are you complaining about things? You don't even know who's in it. Well, that's right. Our senators and representatives who voted for it don't even know what the heck is in it, Mike. Now, to me, there's something wrong in that. I think if I voted for them, they're supposed to read the bill.
Yeah.
So I think you have a lot of political power. And you know what that means. You have political power. You have to make sure that these people who are our employees are doing the right job.
Yeah.
But with this health care, you will see these panels are made up of non-elected people. These are appointed individuals by the people who are organizing the health care.
We call that the good old buddy system.
Yeah.
You said that. You said that again. And it's frightening.
One of the things that Eileen had brought up was the fact that this physician-assisted suicide was being taken from the courts and back into the legislatures. And we have an opportunity coming up this fall, because all of our legislators in the state will be, you know, replaced.
Yes.
Or could be replaced. But we need
wishful
to
thinking.
When you know, before the election, you need to call each one of your representatives or the people running and ask them, where do they stand on physician assisted suicide? Because this is a very, very important issue that will really determine the state of our state, really. And we really do not want people in there. And I don't care what else they stand for. If they stand for physician-assisted suicide, they should not be elected.
Of course not.
We need to keep them from being reelected.
Of course not. And I think that's a good litmus test, and abortion. You got two issues here. And if they're not willing to talk about it, then
a lot of times people say, well, you know, whether they're pro-life or pro-choice, it doesn't really matter because they're not going to be making any decisions. Well, physician-assisted suicide is an instance where we know it's coming up and we can prevent it from happening in the ballot box. And I think this is so important because when we as a society say that there are instances when life is not worth living, that is telling our children the wrong message.
Of course.
There are so many teenage suicides nowadays.
Of course.
If we at all ever say, I would not want to live like that, Do you know how emotionally crazy teenagers are?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
A zit on prom night, you know, anything can set them mm-hmm. off. I mean, we've got kids that are killing themselves mm-hmm. because they were bullied, for criminy's sake. This is absolutely not the message we want to send our kids.
And I think what you're talking about and what Mike is talking about is a cultural kind of change. So it is important what happens here in Connecticut. It is important what every person does, because it changes the whole society that we live in. We're living together.
Right.
Okay? We are the children of God, whether people know it or not. Anything we do affects everybody else, not in a New Agey way, but in a real spiritual way, because we are God's children. And we have to stand for the right thing. So I think that's very hopeful, because someone like Mike, who's at home, or someone who can't even get out of the house and can just send in a mail-in ballot, right, can affect things. Anybody can do something charitable, something good, something positive to change. And if you can only say your rosary every day for the conversion of abortionists or for the conversion of Emmanuel and his brother Ezekiel, then you know what? That's what you can do.
Absolutely.
And that's big.
It's
because
huge.
Prayer is what it's all about. I have everyone in the nursing homes praying for everybody else and praying for me. So that's, you know, we keep them alive with that kind of,
absolutely.
It's prayer that is powerful. And someday we will know that. We will know that the veil will be lifted, right? And then we'll see clearly.
I was just thinking not too long ago, you know, if you go to daily mass, it's always like, you know, the old people are in the
mm-hmm.
And I think, thank God for the
God.
Old people.
Of course.
If we start killing them off, who's going to be praying for everybody?
Right.
We really need our elderly population.
But we don't understand that, you see. And this is what I tell the people in the nursing home. Say, here's a rosary, you know. Just say your rosaries for me, for my patients, for the nurses, for the doctors.
For our country.
Well, yeah. And they take that on. They do it. There are prayer warriors in those places.
Absolutely.
And that's another reason why we got to keep them alive.
Absolutely.
We need their prayers. You know, who's to say the value of a human life except God, who created it? You know, we are not here to make those decisions.
That's what it really boils down to.
Yes.
Is that, you know, we need to get out of the mindset that we know everything and that we need to control everything. Because, you know, it's a joke. We're not in control.
No, we're not in control.
We really
in control of anything.
To let God, you know, do his thing, and we'd be so much happier as a people and
that's
as
right.
a society.
And pick up your rosary and say your rosary every day and get to mass as much as you can. Sit in front of the Blessed Sacrament, you know, and you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
No matter if the world's falling down around you. That's all that matters.
And I think that's the best thing that we can do right now.
That's the best thing we can do right now.
Especially when it feels so overwhelming.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. We hope that you've learned something. We hope that you talk to your family and friends about the things that you've learned. And we hope that when you look in the mirror the next time, you realize yours too is the face of pro-life. Join us again next time.